This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, there are a chosen few that will stand against the vampires, the demons, and the forces of darkness. These are the voyages of the crew of Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
Welcome to Sci-Fi and Squeam and tonight's show with Sonia and Kaz. We have called this show tonight Gore Girls on Film. We are going to pay tribute to the ladies of horror, the slasher queens, the damsels of distress, and the chicks of the flicks who get the flick, usually permanently and in gory fashion. But first I'd like to say thanks to David and Jade for Different Strokes. It was excellent. Now we're going to look at tonight Janet Leigh to Jamie Leigh, and that's just a taste for this week. So tonight is actually part one of a two-parter. Next week we'll look at more horror and the female content. And tonight for part one we started with the soundtrack to Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's classic. We'll be looking at Carrie and Halloween Queens, to Teeth, to Beyond on Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. And tonight's SMS topic is, who is your beloved queen of the scream? Or scream queens, they're often called. Or do you have a favourite slasher movie that's filled with ladies? And why? Now, we're listening to Psycho, Bernard Herrmann's piece that he composed for Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 film. So Psycho is something that Kaz is very knowledgeable about.
I don't know if I'm knowledgeable about it, but I definitely studied it in high school and I really, really enjoy it. So we are going to talk a little bit about famous screen icons of the female persuasion, and one of the biggest has to be Janet Leigh from Psycho. Now, Psycho is one of Alfred Hitchcock's most memorable and imitated films, that's for sure. It was released in 1960 and it scared the bejesus out of moviegoers with the infamous shower scene in which Janet Leigh's character Marion Crane is stabbed to death by the hotelier and serial killer Norman Bates. Now, it's pretty well known that Hitchcock did everything he could to keep the story under wraps. He bought up all the copies of the original novel so that hardly anyone would know how the story ended. He also filmed on a closed set and forced cast and crew to sign an agreement promising not to mention the ending to anyone. There were no advanced screenings. Now, I'm not sure how he would have done it had he been working in this age of internet and video cameras. But from 1960 onwards, the focus of Psycho has been the shocking shower sequence in which Janet Leigh's character is slashed to death. The scene comprises over 70 shots, each lasting 2 or 3 seconds, and it's become one of the most infamous moments in horror movie history, and probably in cinema history, actually.
It still is ranked as number one, apparently. I had a little bit of research the other day, and it took 7 days to complete the whole footage.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Hitchcock mixed fast cutting and screeching music and created the illusion of violence and nudity while actually revealing very little. There are no shots of the knife penetrating skin. There are no shots of open knife wounds. And finally, there are no shots of blood spurting, as you might sort of expect in a slasher film. Now, the scene's been scrutinised by filmmakers who have been inspired, and no more so than Gus Van Sant, who actually remade the film in 1998 with Anne Heche as Marion and Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates. It's also come under the gaze of writers who have reflected on the scene's importance to cinema and to representations of women in horror, which is what we're looking at tonight. It's often critiqued in a framework that includes Hitchcock's reputation as a misogynist. Now, I don't know how you feel about that, Sonia, but I'm always confused as to whether he was something, a reputation that he himself built up kind of purposefully, or whether it's something that has been attributed to him
I think it's been attributed to him. I think he's like a lot of directors who will find a piece of work might be in a novel or, you know, some story, and he takes that and he will remodel it. Because he did work very closely with his partner, his wife, of many years, yes, and they actually colluded together. So maybe she's also a misogynist.
Well, either that or else they've created a lot of mythology around his films. Mm. And the cinema writer Ian Morrison has commented that Psycho gives us a transgressive woman who is murdered by a sexually deviant male with a peculiar relationship with his mother. Because yes, Hitchcock chooses to film extended murder sequences in these scenarios, he provokes many thematic and psychological questions about his portrayal of women and their guilt and punishability, which I thought was an interesting idea. Now, whatever your view is of the film, there's no denying that Hitchcock builds up the emotion to a nearly unbearable height during that particular shower scene.
It's brilliant. It's still amazing. The
today,
the shots of the blood with a bit of water going down the drain
and the
eye.
And
so it's very, very excellent.
It was very funny. Funny version of that in The Simpsons where Maggie hits
Homer
over the head.
Oh, okay.
Now Janet Leigh herself shared her horror with the viewers. Mm. In her first interviews after the film's release, she said, "I believed that knife went into me. It was that real, that horrifying."
They used a melon, apparently. And for the sound effects, they used the melon, which is a brilliant sound effect.
They did. It works really, really well. And the irony of her statement was, you know, "I could feel it," is that, of course, Leigh was not on camera during the shooting of much of those scenes, and especially the most harrowing. Mm. The body in those scenes is actually that of a model who went by the name of Marley Renfro. A US writer, Robert Graysmith, who wrote Zodiac, about the Zodiac Killer, has written a book, The Girl in Alfred Hitchcock's Shower.
Okay.
And it was always believed that Renfro was a Dallas-born stripper who was one of the first Playboy bunnies. And after her foray into film, she was forgotten until in 2001, it was reported that a man had been arrested for her 1988 murder. Now, Graysmith was fascinated by this story of a woman who had been murdered, seemingly in a horrible echo of the fictional one in which she'd played such a crucial role. Obviously, the killing of Marion Crane in Psycho. Now, the 2001 report alleged that Kenneth Dean Hunt had been convicted of killing an actress who was a body double for Janet Leigh in the film Psycho. However, the report names Amira Davis, saying that this was Marley Renfro's real name. Graysmith became further intrigued, and in his subsequent investigations, he revealed that Marley Renfro and Myra Davis, which was said to be an alias, they were in fact two completely separate people. And here's how the confusion arose. Marley Renfro was Janet Leigh's body double on set, but Myra Davis was the stand-in. Now, a stand-in does not actually appear on camera.
Yeah, no.
They're used to check lighting setups and camera angles and that
And
sort
they're usually
of thing.
The same height and build.
Yeah, exactly.
Obvious so reasons get for the camera person.
Yeah, the camera person to get it right. Now, Graysmith suggests that in his book that Kenneth Dean Hunt was obsessed with the film and wanted to kill Leigh's body double, but killed her stand-in by mistake. Probing further, Graysmith discovered that the body double, Marley Renfro, was actually still alive and kicking, and she had no idea that she'd been reported murdered. Now, the one who had lived, Marley Renfro, the body double, was paid $500, sorry, for starring in one of cinema's most iconic scenes, and was never paid a penny more, despite the film making $15 million in its first year of release alone. Mm. Now, Janet Leigh and Alfred Hitchcock continually maintained that it was Leigh's body in all of the shots.
Yeah, she says that in one interview I read, which celebrated her passing away, Janet Leigh passed away in 2004, actually said that she wore like a moleskin, flesh-coloured moleskin
that
suit.
That was true, that she wore like the moleskin on her nipples, but she wasn't in those scenes.
Oh, I see.
Where, I mean, she wasn't in all of them. That wasn't her naked body in a lot of that. They created a lie and a myth that surrounded the film, and it quite possibly contributed to the success of it and the legacy. Because the story, of course, goes that thousands of people developed a phobia.
Including herself. She has claimed to have said that she did not like showering.
After seeing the film. Mm. I mean that works well for media as well.
That's very good marketing.
She does. Of course, for some people, it's just a convenient excuse to walk around without showering. For a scene, though, that's made such an impact, it's really interesting to keep in mind that the blood was actually chocolate syrup. And as you mentioned, Sonia, the sound of the knife stabbing the flesh was actually a knife being stabbed repeatedly into melons of all different sizes. Ooh, so watermelon,
get the right effect.
Yep. And in some scenes, Anthony Perkins, who played Norman Bates, was not even present. He was in New York preparing for a play, and a double dressed up in the mother outfit instead. Now, it would be interesting to know how Janet Leigh felt about her performance, taking a back seat to the impact of body doubles, ice cream topping, and fruit.
Right.
I think it's fair to say that Psycho is the first true slasher film.
Yep.
With the murder of Janet Leigh's character, Marion Crane, we see who is a sexually independent woman, a woman, Marion, being stabbed with one of those sort of phallically symbolic knives.
Mm.
The murder represents Marion's punishment.
Even the size of the knife is so reminiscent. You see it in Halloween,
and
the flash of the knife.
Absolutely,
in
the curve
every,
of the knife,
yep,
in the shadow.
It's not a little kitchen knife, and a lot of stabbings are often the first implement you can find.
It does, and they come from such a high angle,
yep,
as well.
So it's the
not,
light catches
you know,
them.
It's gutting.
Yeah.
It's coming from
It's not a
from
fish
high.
Knife.
No, so it's a very sort of significant thing. A sexually repressed kind of Norman Bates takes away her sexual power through this act. We've got a few messages, but
yes,
after that, we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about Psycho, particularly the effect of Norman Bates' mother. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam with Sonia and Kaz on Joy 94.9, and we are talking about Psycho. We've gone over a little bit of what Janet Leigh's impact was in the film, but I think we should talk a little bit about the mother.
Because it's like two different films when you look at it. The first part of the film is about a woman who is desperate to get money. She's in a job and real estate agents, and there's an opportunity for her to take $40,000. Her boyfriend needs the money for his alimony to his ex-wife. So she doesn't even inform him of that. She just does it. She has a migraine or something and goes home with the money, doesn't bank it, and heads off into the West.
That's
on the road,
and
it's her guilt all the way through that, because she's actually going to return to Phoenix, where she's come from, apparently.
Well,
she says that to Norman.
They have a scene where it kind of goes, the thoughts run through her head.
Yeah, it's a brilliant scene in the car with the rain.
Now it doesn't seem that innovative, but back then...
And then she suddenly finds herself off the road, down a dark road, there's no traffic, suddenly there's a motel sign with vacancy. Like, is she just going into another realm or something? And this is what happens to people who are guilty of crime.
Well, that's
what I felt like. This is like
the irony,
guilt trip. You know?
The irony of the situation in Psycho is that as soon as she decides she's going to give the money back, she has a shower and it's almost like a cleansing. She kind of starts to feel better about herself.
As you
she's
do.
She's going to go back. She's going to fix it. It'll be fine. She'll
you
go
do.
The next
we all
day,
do that.
No one will know.
Yep.
And then it's all foiled by Norman Bates coming in after he's watched her and, he kills her.
I mean, spoiler alert, but I'm sure everyone does know
the
plot
of
Psycho. Where have you been for 50 years? 50 years. It'll be 50 years this year, actually. It was released in...
it will be in the middle of the year, I think.
1960. Cool.
Yeah.
Now, we have some SMSs here. Somebody's sent in, Adam actually, saying he recently watched Drag Me to Hell, and I have to say the actress in that definitely has my 5-star vote. She knows how to work with groundbreaking effect. That's very good. And very humorous dialogue. It was a very daggy film, I think. Mia Farrow in Rosemary's Baby. That's another excellent one. And The Haunting of Julia. Also pretty amazing. Thank you, Adam.
I haven't seen The Haunting of Julia.
It's been a while since I've seen it. But, it's a very turgid bit. And we've got Robert in Northcote says the cellar scene where the mother is actually in the cellar.
Yes, that's
petrified.
Right. Mummified.
Petrified, mummified, yeah.
That is quite scary. And the thing about Psycho is you don't really know what Bates' feeling is towards his mother. I mean...
You're told at the end of the film...
Well, that's it.
...by the psychiatric police officer who has to, and like a lot of these films made in that era, they always explain what was going on in the killer's head. Like,
right.
I don't know if you've seen Joan Crawford in Berserk.
No, I haven't.
But at the end of the film, she explains... You know, she explains why this person was committing these crimes using her wig and her clothing, and why was it her daughter was performing these psychotic murderous acts.
Yeah,
it's like you have to tell the audience. Whereas today, I guess maybe we're just too clever for our own good.
We could be, although I have to say that
maybe not.
Maybe considering when you read forum boards after, you know, a film's come out, people ask a lot of stupid questions. So maybe they should still have that.
Maybe.
So we have been talking a little bit about Psycho, which has some key elements. It has the repressed sort of sexual repression and the mother very Freudian sort of mother
matricide.
Figure.
Matricide?
Yes. Well, it's got which matricide,
very
of course.
Good. No.
And it has that horrible murder of a young woman.
Mm.
And we are talking a little bit more about... We're still going to branch out and talk a little bit about The Exorcist.
That's
and
right.
Women's representation in that.
The Exorcist, now, that came out in 1973, directed by William Friedkin and written by William Peter Blatty, starred the wonderful Alan Burstyn and Linda Blair, of course, as the young possessed Regan. It had the wonderful Max von Sydow as a exorcist priest expert and Jason Miller as a psychiatrist priest called Father Karras. Lee J. Cobb also appears in it as a police detective. Now, a little thing about the actual film. The woman that did the voice for the possessed Linda Blair character of Regan was not even credited at the time of the release of the film. Her name was Mercedes McCambridge. And, she had to go through some legal situations to get her name on the DVD when it finally did come out on DVD.
Yeah, I do remember hearing that, actually.
Years later. And William Friedkin, you could say definitely he had some misogynistic issues there. He had a bit of trouble with the emancipation of females at the time. Now, it was made in 1973. And by this stage, I guess, you know, Woman's Lib, as it was called then, was in full swing. Literally. He was a neighbour, apparently, to none other than Shirley MacLaine. And she was quite vocal about women's rights and anti-Vietnam. And
yeah, she's also
like
vocal
that.
About things like psychics.
Yeah, that was in the 80s. She did the 70s. She burnt
and
her bra.
And then she moved into
and then
the,
it just went a bit downhill from there. Now, he saw this whole movement of the emancipation of women and women's rights as fundamentally flawed and dangerous. And Shirley MacLaine was actually a single mother at the time, as Hollywood a neighbour in Beverly Hills. And, yeah, he basically has been, you know, quoted as saying he wanted to make a film to show girls that, you know, they can't or shouldn't have everything. And so he made The Exorcist, but he also based it on that film by William Blatty. And both the film and novel took inspiration from an actual documented exorcism in 1949, but on a 14-year-old boy. Mm. So he changed the sex and everything. And
and
I think most people know what happens with the film. It's pretty graphic. It still is a great classic of all time, I believe.
It is, and I think it's still, I mean, I think it was just, it's not still banned in the UK, is it?
I know of. I know that Clockwork Orange still has issues, but
I think The Exorcist was definitely banned for a time.
It was for a time. Now, Friedkin apparently went to some extraordinary lengths during the making of the film, and his manipulation of the actors to get genuine reactions. He basically, both Linda Blair and Burstyn suffered back injuries due to harnesses that they were put on, so they were thrown around the room. Literally, there was no stunt people involved.
She absolutely was injured quite severely.
And this is what he was like. He was a perfectionist. He modelled himself on D.W. Griffiths. And he just thought, I'm going to make this epic, which I think it is.
He accomplished that. But
definitely.
At what
price, at a price. And, of course, with his actual take on feminism, it was quite interesting to see where that led to. I think it's a brilliant film. And it certainly stands out as one of the greatest horror films of all time. But I've included it in the slasher because even though it's not actually a slasher film and it still has all those elements, I think, of
It's still
why women are portrayed in a serious way like this.
It takes that religious aspect in as well, though. So that idea
kind
of the woman being vulnerable to
the scene with
the crucifix.
We know about that scene.
If you don't know what we're talking about, look it up on YouTube.
Yeah, get it out on DVD. It's pretty graphic.
Yeah, the whole fact that it's kind of... Again, these two male priests, I mean, not that you can get any other kind, but they come in and they sort of this girl who's on the brink of womanhood.
That's right. It's prepubescent.
Yep, that idea of adolescence somehow corrupting.
Her father is absent. We only hear him on the phone.
Yes,
he misses her birthday. And that's when he misses her birthday because he can't make it. He's in Rome or something. When he can't make it. Of course he is. And basically it all starts to go...
Of course, and it is a
belly up
crucial,
or bed up.
Yeah, it's a crucial representation. I mean, like you said, it was based on the story of a 14-year-old boy.
Yep.
And I think it would have made a very different film and a very different impact.
I don't think people would have gone to see it in droves. Like, it was a huge hit.
I think it's harder for people to watch every exorcism film or play I've seen, and we talked a bit about Furious Mattress a couple of weeks ago.
It's also a female
possession.
Exactly. Funny that. She's having a bad day. She's got PMS, or she's having her, you know, she's growing up. She's a young woman. Oh, she must be possessed by the devil.
And it kind of puts them at that brink. They're ripe for possession by, it's the whole Eve thing all over again.
All over again. And an interesting author called Barbara Creed, she wrote that the psychoanalytical claim that at the heart of the cinematic horror lies a patriarchal fear of female sexuality. In accordance with this fear, it is held that the genre defines female sexuality as monstrous, disturbing, and in need of repression.
Well, there you go. Again, it kind of ties back to that, the idea of Psycho, and how many feminist and, you know, just cinematic writers have said that it's about taking these women down a peg or two.
And remember, that was 1960. So things were changing then. The Pearl came out in 1963 in the US. 1965, I think it was in Australia and New Zealand, but a husband or a partner had to actually sign for it. A woman couldn't get it. She had to have the prescription signed by a male and then a male doctor. So these liberties come with a price.
Absolutely. But I think that, and we'll be talking about this a little bit later on, that women have, the portrayal of women have changed, and they have a lot more agency in these kinds of films. Maybe not so much in things like, if you look at The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah.
Again, she's very much at the mercy of the people around her.
Yep.
But
it's a brilliant film.
Yeah, it's not a bad film, but it's, again, she has very little say in what happens in her own life.
That's true.
But
instead of it being, I guess, The Exorcism for Emily Rose, she's in a very equivalent of America, whereas this one is set in Georgetown. The Exorcist is set in Georgetown, which is the heart of America, the capital, Washington, D.C. So what are we saying? And it's around a Hollywood movie
true.
Set.
And, you've got,
and we've got women who are dating directors, and we've got, you know, we've got German servants who are sort of subjected to be called Nazis because they're Germans. There's a lot going on in this film.
Definitely
worth watching again.
The female and the political aspect.
Yes, yes.
You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam. Sonia and I, Kaz, are speaking about women, representation of women in horror films. We are going to come back after these messages. First, we're going to play a little bit from Carrie, which was the Brian De Palma film from 1976.
76. Yep.
Excellent. Excuse me. And we're going to play that for you. We'll be back after this. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9 with Kaz and Sonia.
That was Carrie. The trailer. It was awesome. Have you seen it?
Pretty chilling. Yeah, I actually prefer the book. I'm one of those people who really enjoy the book.
I just love Brian De Palma. I think he's an amazing director. And this one.
Oh, it's and Sissy Spacek.
A friend of mine says that, and this is nothing against Sissy Spacek because I think she's a wonderful actress, says that it's like a fetus with blood on its face.
It is. She's got that horrible look on her face.
Permanently. It's awesome.
It's just, and a creepy kind of head. And
yes,
yeah, really
very
works
stiff
for her.
Working, yeah. Now, that was made in 1976, as I said, by Brian De Palma, the director, and it starred Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie as her mama. And it was written by... Screenplay was written by Lawrence D. Cohen and based on the novel by Stephen King, which you said you read. And the film and the novel deal with a socially outcast teenage girl called Carrie White. And now she discovers she possesses psionic power, or like telekinesis power, which seems to flare up when she becomes angry, which is no good. Carrie's powers become apparent after a humiliation by her peers, her teachers, her abusive mother, and eventually it results in ultimate tragedy, of course. Like I said, it starred Sissy Spacek, but also has Betty Buckley, Amy Irving, who was once Mrs. Spielberg, Nancy Allen, William Catt, and John Travolta in one of his first roles for the big screen.
Oh, yeah, I forgot William Catt. He was the
greatest American hero. Daggy, but funny.
Not much of a hero.
Not really. Now, the film was a major success for the UA, or United Artists, grossing over $30 million at the US box office, which is huge for the time. Massive. And it was made on a budget of only $1.8 million US. It received a mostly positive response from critics, and the film spawned sequels such as The Rage, Carrie 2, and also a made-for-television remake, which I didn't really like very much. It was made in 2002.
Yeah, I saw a bit of that actually.
It didn't have anything to do with Brian De Palma, and I think that makes a huge difference. Now, Carrie's ridiculed at school, like I said, and emotionally abused by her unstable mother, who's a religious fanatic. Carrie learns she has these telekinetic powers and uses them to get revenge on her tormentors. Her first period and blood-soaked school prom provide the gore, and it's a real rite of passage film for me, and that's what Brian De Palma said when he was making it, because it was one of the earliest films he did. Now, it's pretty much all downhill after she does get her period, and her mother says it's the devil, basically. Satan's come.
Well, that's pretty much, yeah.
It's pretty backward.
She's unclean, quite literally.
Yes, devil's business. Now, her mother's played by, as I said, Piper Laurie, one of her best Scream Queen roles, and she's a cruel and mad religious Christian fanatic. And you just want Carrie to be released from this horrible, evil woman, actually.
She never has a chance.
Not really. But, spoiler alert, it all comes to a bloody end for all those people that were, you know, the haters out there, as they say, who were pretty nasty to Carrie. Carrie gets carried away.
We do know what happens.
But some of the good people that try to understand and have empathy for Carrie, everyone gets it. Because telekinesis doesn't actually
discriminate.
No, everyone gets it pretty much. There's a fire at the prom.
Well, I suppose if you're not, you know, yeah, they were sympathetic, but they were still part of that status quo.
And the scene with the pig's blood that falls on Carrie as she becomes, and it's apparently rigged that she becomes the queen of the prom. Now, she's up there. She's a very reserved, withdrawn young lady. And it's one of those classic horror images and scenes in which, you know, they just sticks and impregnates in your memory forever. And De Palma was an expert at the way that whole scene was shot, the prom scene. The way he edits it and spliced it together is just amazing, different angles. And when you see it on the big screen, which I have, you just see this incredible... It's almost like Apocalypse Now, but it's a slasher movie.
Oh, it is.
A horror movie.
It does actually have that war film feel now.
It's like a war film and the fire and everybody gets it. It's a masterpiece, and you can actually see it as being heavily influenced by another master of horror cinema and gore, and that would be Dario Argento. There's also some nods of the head towards Mario Bava. So there's a lot of the great Italian kings of horror, and they certainly had their take on women in film, but that's another subject altogether. So polyester and prom suits and tiaras will never be quite the same after you see Carrie.
No, they won't.
No.
And it really did set up that whole high school as a horror thing for the outsider.
Yeah, it did. Yep. There's prom night. There's prom so night, many Scream franchises.
It's funny when you go and you watch films or TV shows about high school life, and people will pull out a line like, you know, don't go all carry on me now. Because
it
basically
that's where
becomes
it comes
synonymous
from.
with people freaking out at high school.
I know. It's bizarre.
I mean, you know.
Or don't go Michael Myers on me, you know, when you put a mask on and you creep up behind someone with a knife. People get weird about that, don't they?
Funnily enough.
They get funny. People get funny. Yeah, so that was Carrie, just talking about the original film, made in 76 by Brian De Palma. Go and watch it, people. It's really worth it.
It definitely is. Now, we are talking about Scream Queens.
You're listening to Sonia and Kaz on Sci-Fi and Scream. I was going to say Scream because I've been saying Scream most of the evening tonight. And we're also going to be looking at Jamie Lee Curtis, of course, daughter of Janet Leigh from Psycho, and about her career and where it all started for her in the slasher genre. And we've also got some of the top five horror directors who are actually women. What else have we got here? My goodness.
We're talking about a bit.
Quite a few things, actually.
We're just going to play a little bit more from Carrie, just to get you in the mood.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back after this.
And the raven was called Sin. I don't know where they get those from. Old Testament, maybe?
I don't even know if that's... I mean, I don't know if it's in the Bible or not.
I don't know either, but it's brilliant nonetheless.
They should put it in there.
They should. And that's Piper Laurie, who she plays the best crazy mother you've ever seen. And why have they got red hair? I don't know why I just said that, but often
that,
they do.
That whole redheaded
The redhead gene.
We've explored that a little bit before.
Jamie Lee Curtis. She started her career with the first Halloween film in 1978, directed by John Carpenter and produced and written by Deborah Hill. Then she went on to do The Fog, also by Carpenter and Hill, followed by a Canadian horror film not many people know about called Terror Train. It's worth the watch. It's got David Copperfield in it as a magician.
Wow, that would, that would actually horrify me.
It's a bit odd. And finishing off the year of 1980, she did Prom Night. So she was very busy, a very busy woman back then. All in one year of 1980. Now, she certainly, I would say, is the Scream Queen still.
She definitely is. Mm-hmm. Halloween is one of the only movies that I can't watch without freaking out.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. I think it's the mask that Michael Myers wears.
You want to know something about the mask?
I know.
You know what I'm going to say.
Tell the listeners, though, just in case they don't know.
It is him, William Shatner.
It is.
Apparently.
It's the William Shatner mask. It was
been altered slightly
painted over. But
I can see it.
It must be that
really scary.
I can tell it's him. And it's still.
Oh, happy birthday again, William. He will be remembered for not just Star Trek and not just his wonderful music.
No, with his
books.
And wonderful music.
I love that album. I've got it at home somewhere.
But he will be, yeah.
And he'll be remembered as Michael Myers' mask. Now, the year is the year of Halloween, of course. And for all of those who don't know about Halloween or you're unconverted, so if you're a Halloween virgin, the following plot runs like this. Jamie Lee plays a person called Laurie Strode. The story surrounds a serial killer called Michael Myers. Now, he seems to have it in for Laurie and her friends and just about anyone that gets in his way. This was the first film, actually, that was labelled a slasher. And as Michael Myers mounts up the body count before coming after Laurie. It's a classic, and it's the start of a great franchise, according to some people. The cinematic style is very, very Carpenter-esque. It's actually, when you watch it again, you realise how slow it is. So we'll talk more in a moment about Halloween and Jamie Lee. Yes, Sci-Fi and Scream, we're looking at Gore Girls on Film, or Slasher Queens, tonight, and we've been looking at Halloween. Jamie Lee. That was where her career probably took off, I would say, with the Michael Myers series and the old kitchen knife and the William Shatner mask. And it's 1980 when she goes on to do Terror Train and then Prom Night later in the same year. Now, if you haven't seen Halloween, you need to, because it is probably the Carpenter, the Hill team's best film, I would say.
I'd definitely say it stands out not just as a horror film, but as a film. And Jamie Lee Curtis she's just standout.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it was shot in only 20 days. It cost $300,000 to make. And to date, it has made over $50 million. And that's not talking about maybe all the other side avenues and marketing and all the other franchise films that followed that. It certainly is amazing to know that a slasher film has almost got its own life of its own. And when people say Halloween, often they don't think of Halloween, they're thinking of the film.
They do. Mm. Although I've had conversations with people where they've confused Halloween with Friday the 13th and
and Nightmare.
Nightmare on Elm Street. But mainly Friday the 13th.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay.
True. Now, Jamie Lee Curtis and other scream queens on the big screen. These are some of Jamie Lee's screamers. Halloween in 1978, of course. The Fog, 1980, as I mentioned. Prom Night. Terror Train. And an Australian classic called Road Games, made in 1981. Have you seen that?
I've heard of it.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's really classic. Halloween 2 in 1981, where she still plays Laurie Strode, because she survives, you see. She's a survivor.
Well, that was the key. She doesn't get done in at the end.
No. Goes on.
She fights away. Yes, granted, she should have gotten out of that house a hell of a lot earlier than she does.
But
that's just a personal quibble of mine. But she makes it.
And she even appears 20 years later in 1998 in Halloween H20.
Sorry. Pretty bad film.
Janet Leigh was in that as well, her mum.
Yes, she was. And so was Josh Hartnett as Laurie's son.
And Halloween Resurrection in 2002.
Didn't
really get into that. I didn't watch it all, actually. It's just passed me by. There's other great screamers from the past, like Fay Wray would be one of the originals from King Kong in 1933.
Of course.
Who can forget that scream? Bette Davis, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? Personal favourite of mine. Have you seen it?
I have. And yep. Again, it's one of those films that makes a very big impact.
True. She was also in Death on the Nile, Wicked Stepmother in 1989, and Murder with Mirrors in 1985. Joan Crawford, of course, Berserk, and she was next to Bette Davis in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane in 1962. Straitjacket's another brilliant film Joan Crawford was in. Tippi Hedren, of course, and The Birds. 1963, as Melanie Daniels, a Hitchcock classic. And look, we could go on. There are so many queens out there.
That is. But we are going to play a little bit of an interview with Jamie Lee Curtis. And this is from, I believe, when she was filming The Fog.
The Fog. Yep.
Excellent. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream. And that was Jamie Lee Curtis, who we were listening to on the set of The Fog, or just after The Fog was released, on an interview there. She sounds exactly the same.
It's amazing. She still sounds, yeah.
Fantastic.
Like herself.
She really does. We're talking about Scream Queens on Sci-Fi and Scream tonight. Now, there was a film called Teeth. It was released in 2007, and it was billed by some as a feminist horror film. Now, Teeth is a black comedy horror film written and directed by Mitchell Lichtenstein, who is an actor turned director. And in a nutshell, it's the story of a teenage girl who has teeth in her vagina. Now, Dawn is a high school student who grew up in the shadow of a nuclear power plant, which may have had an effect on her own biology. She's concerned about her own awakening libido, and to counter it, she becomes the most active participant in a Christian abstinence group called The Promise. Sounds like fun. Through the group, she meets Toby, and ironically finds herself sexually attracted to him. After a few group dates, Dawn and Toby acknowledge their attraction to each other and they agree to spend some time apart. It's what Jesus would have wanted. Now, it's not long before they give in and meet at a local swimming hole. After swimming together, Dawn and Toby head into a cave to get warm and they begin kissing. Toby then forces himself on Dawn, and in a panic, her vagina bites off his penis. Oh. Horrified, Dawn flees. In an attempt to understand what happened, Dawn researches an affliction known as vagina dentata and visits a gynecologist to get checked out. Now, the good doctor takes advantage of his patient and molests her under the guise of performing an examination. Now, Dawn's vagina bites the fingers off his hand in
this is like Deep Throat. It's almost the same plot, just about. There's a doctor in that scene as well.
Well, after that, Dawn heads home seeking refuge, but her disgusting stepbrother is no help, and in the meantime, her mother falls gravely ill. With nowhere to turn, Dawn seeks help from a friend, Ryan, to whom she's always had an attraction. Now, the two have sex without incident, and Dawn spends the night at his house. The next morning, Dawn and Ryan try it again, but Ryan's friend calls in the middle of it and reveals to Dawn that he and Ryan had a bet going that Ryan would sleep with her. And in anger, of course, Dawn's vagina bites off Ryan's penis and she leaves. I kind of can't stop laughing when I read those bits. While she's been away, however, her mother has passed away. And emboldened by her new power, Dawn goes to seek revenge on her stepbrother, whose negligence and behaviour contributed to her mother's death. Dawn seduces her stepbrother and they have sex. And, of course, you can guess what happens then. Dawn realises that she needs to find her own way in the world. And in a sense, the film kind of shapes the idea that she needs to become her own hero. At the end of the film, she ends up hitchhiking and is picked up by an old man who refuses to let her out of the car until she has sex with him. Now, Dawn hesitates, but the last shot we see is of her turning to the old man with a smile on her face. And it seems she's finally turned her curse to her advantage. Now, Dawn's affliction, vagina dentata, is Latin for toothed vagina. There are a few different cultures that have folk tales about women with teeth in their vaginas, and these are usually told as cautionary tales, warning of the dangers of sex with strange women. I'm not sure exactly what makes them strange besides the obvious. Ooh. And to discourage rape.
Do they have braces? Of course a good thing. If they're, you know.
If they're a bit out of shape, then yeah. Probably, yeah, they do. Do you get them cleaned and.
Yeah. Gross.
Nice.
Disclaimer.
It kind of ties in with that Freudian idea of castration anxiety as well on the male side. In some of the myths, the hero, who is a man, of course, breaks the teeth of the vagina and turns the creature into a real woman. in inverted commas. In a more sober sense, it could indicate a very real male anxiety about sex with women. Now, the myth
like a root canal. Literally.
Literally, I like that. The myth of vagina dentata has made its way into the real world, funnily enough, in the form of the rape axe. This is an anti-rape female condom invented by Sonette Ehlers, who's a South African woman. Now, Ehlers was motivated to create it while working as a blood technician with the South African Blood Transfusion Service, during which time she met many rape victims. And according to good old Wikipedia, the rape axe is a latex sheath embedded with shafts of sharp inward-facing barbs that would be worn by a woman in her vagina like a tampon.
But where did they do the testing for this? You know, I don't for safety.
Don't even want to know. If an attacker were to attempt vaginal rape, his penis would enter the latex sheath and be snagged by the barbs, causing the attacker excruciating pain during
withdrawal. See, there's real horror in the real world.
There is, and ideally giving the woman time to escape. Now, the condom would remain attached to the attacker's body when he withdrew and could only be removed surgically, which would obviously alert the hospital staff and the police. Like most condoms, the rape axe also prevents, usually, pregnancy and transmission of HIV and STIs. It's debatable how effective this would be and when a woman would actually wear it. Like, do you just go out with it just in case? If you're not too horrified by that, maybe think about how life in South Africa is for women and how very different it is to life in Australia.
Pretty frightening. I mean, District 9 only touches the tip of the iceberg.
It really doesn't. Only really involves men. Whereas in South Africa in 2006, there were close to 55,000 reported rape cases. However, there are an estimated 450,000 rape cases that go unreported.
Oh, dear.
That's 505,000.
Who needs horror movies when,
Well, that's what made me think about it.
Yep.
I sort of thought, you
know. Good point.
We talk about horror films where women are subjected to oppression and they're brought down. And in a movie like Teeth, it's ridiculous, of course, but she gets her own back. And in a weird way, it's kind of transitioned into real life. And so we have 505,000 rape cases or so in 2006 in South Africa, compared to about 7,200 that were reported in 2004, 2005 in Australia, in the two most populous states, Victoria and New South Wales. So just a brief comparison there, and about how horrific real life can be for women sometimes.
True enough.
Not to make it too serious, but, you know. Get these things out there.
Thanks. I feel really cheerful now.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's great.
Sorry to any guys out there.
It's not great. It's very serious.
Passed out during that.
Movie and casting news. War of Gods is now the film formerly known as War of Gods, as production company Relativity Media has announced that it's changed its name to Immortals. Directed by Tarsem Singh, who directed The Cell. He's wonderful. It's a film version of the Greek mythological hero Theseus, who leads his men into battle with the gods to defeat evil and the powerful elder gods of the Titans in order to save mankind. Its stars include John Hurt, Isabel Lucas, Henry Cavill, Stephen Dorff, Luke Evans, Cullen Lutz, Joseph Morgan, Fredo Pinto, and Mickey Rourke. Filming commences this month for an 11 November 2011 release date.
Now, not much was known about former Buffy cohorts Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon's horror movie The Cabin in the Woods until Amy, Fred from Angel Acker, started blabbing to Sci-Fi Wire at WonderCon this weekend. She confirmed that the film is indeed a creature feature. There's a lot of scary monsters, she says. Acker co-stars with Richard Jenkins, Bradley Whitford, Kristen Connolly and Chris Hemsworth, and the film was due to be released earlier this year until it was decided to make the whole thing 3D.
And in other news, True Blood star Anna Paquin has opened up about her sexuality, revealing she is bisexual. Paquin, 27, made the revelation in a video recording for the True Colours Fund, an organisation which campaigns for equal rights regardless of sexuality. US gossip websites report and that in the video, which is yet to be made public, Paquin reportedly says, "I'm bisexual and I give a damn." The statement is a reference to the title of a campaign called Give a Damn, which has been endorsed by other celebrities including Elton John and Cynthia Nixon. Paquin, who shot to fame as a child star in the 1993 film The Piano, is said to have stunned friends and co-stars with the unexpected disclosure. The Canadian-born, New Zealand-raised actress is currently engaged to actor Stephen Moyer, her co-star in the popular vampire TV show True Blood. Paquin said in a recent interview that she was surprised to have fallen for Moyer. "Put it this way, I don't think anyone knew before I did," she said. "It wasn't something we saw happening." Here we go.
And that was some sci-fi and Scream news for you for this week. Thank you for joining us on our Scream Queen special. We're going to have more of this for
We will have part two next week. We'll have a special guest, vampire author Mary Borsellino, and we will be looking at Asian females Asian Females in Horror, and Death Proof, and Jennifer's Body.
Lovely. Look forward to hearing that next week.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.